nervous? Asked Ruth. No, why should I be? Not at all. He's the most charming man you'll ever meet. My own Prince Charming. And she gave her deep-throated, mannish laugh. I glanced over my shoulder at the unmarked minivan following close behind. I could see how this was addictive. I was getting used to it already. Being forced to give it up after it had become a habit would be like letting go of money. But thanks to terrorism, Lang would never have to give it up, never have to stand in line for public transport, never even drive himself. He was as pampered and cocooned as a Romanov before the revolution. We came out of the forest onto the main road, turned left, and almost immediately swung right through the airport perimeter. I stared out of the window in surprise at the big runway. We're here already. When summer, Marty likes to leave his office in Manhattan at 4, said Ruth, and be on the beach by 6. I suppose he has a private jet, I said in an attempt at knowingness. Of course he has a private jet. She gave me a look which made me feel like a hick who'd just used his fish knife to butter his roll. Of course he has a private jet. You don't own a $30 million house and travel to it by bus. The man must have a carbon footprint the size of a Yeti's. I realised then that just about everybody the Langs knew these days had a private jet. Indeed, here came Lang himself, in a corporate Gulfstream, dropping out of the darkening sky and skimming in low over the darkening pines. The driver put his foot down, and a minute later we pulled up outside the little terminal. The plane taxied in from the runway. It was painted dark blue and looked bigger than the usual CEO's phallic symbol, with a high tail and 6 windows either side. When it came to a stop and the engines were cut, the silence over the little airfield was unexpectedly profound. The door opened, the steps were lowered, and out came a couple of special branch men. Lang himself seemed in no hurry to disembark. I could just make him out in the shadows of the interior, shaking hands with the pilot. And finally, almost reluctantly, it seemed to me, he came out and paused at the top of the steps. He glanced round as if he were trying to remember what he was supposed to do. It was on the edge of becoming embarrassing when he caught sight of us watching him through the big glass window. He pointed and waved and grinned in exactly the way he had in his heyday, and the moment, whatever it was, had passed. We left the window just in time to meet him as he came in through the arrivals gate. Hi, darling, he said, and stooped to kiss his wife. He noticed me. Hello, he said. Who are you? I'm your ghost, I said. I regretted it the instant I said it. I conceived it as a witty, self-deprecatory, break-the-ice kind of line, but somehow out there in that deserted airport, amid the greyness and the quietness, it hit precisely the wrong note. Right, he said doubtfully. And although he shook my hand, he also drew his head back slightly, as if to inspect me from a safer distance. Don't worry, Ruth told him. He isn't always such a jerk. It was dark by the time I got back to the house, and the temperature had dropped with the sun. I stood beside the minivan and watched as Lang ducked out of his car and was swept through the door by a swirl of bodyguards and staff. I stayed outside in the cold, still twisting with embarrassment over my gaffe at the airport. To my surprise, the person who realised I was missing and who came out to fetch me was Lang. What on earth are you doing out here? He called from the doorway. Isn't anybody looking after you? Come and have a drink. He steered me towards the room where I'd had coffee that morning. So you have to be me for a month. God help you, he said. Well, I hope it will be a fairly painless procedure for both of us, I said, and hesitated, unsure how to address him. Adam, he said. Call me Adam. So, he went on, how exactly are we supposed to go about this? I'll interview you. I'll turn your answers into prose. I might have to add linking passages, trying to imitate your voice. And how long will this take? Full time. I think if we work really hard, we should be able to break the back of it in a week. A week? I resisted the temptation to point out that $10 million for a week's work wasn't exactly the national minimum wage. I may need to come back to you to plug any holes, but if you can give me till Friday, I'll have enough to rewrite most of this draft. The important thing is we start tomorrow. I'd anticipated that my biggest problem on the first day would be physically getting Adam Lang into a room and keeping him there for long enough to start interviewing him. The strange thing was that when I reached the house, he was already waiting for me. Hi, he said, looking up. Ready to start? I've loaded the manuscript onto this flash drive for you, said Amelia. You're welcome to copy it onto your own computer, but I'm afraid that if you do, your laptop must stay here, locked up overnight. Lang said, so you've actually got my whole book on that? We could get 100 books on that, Adam, said Amelia patiently. Amazing. He shook his head. You know, the worst thing about my life, you get so out of touch. You never go in a shop, everything's done for you. You don't carry any money. If I want some money, even now, I have to ask one of the secretaries or one of the protection boys to get it for me. I couldn't do it myself anyway. I don't know my, what are they called? PIN? You see, I just don't have a clue. He threw up his arms and grinned. This, I said excitedly, is exactly the sort of detail we need to put in your book. Nobody knows this sort of thing. Lang looked startled. I can't put that in. People would think I'm a complete idiot. But it's human detail. I mean it. Let's tell people what it really feels like to be Prime Minister. Not just the policy stuff. Who cares about policy? What fascinates people is always people. That's why you need me. This shouldn't be a book for political hacks. This should be a book for everyone. The People's Memoir, said Amelia dryly, but I ignored her. Do you mind, I asked, if I start recording? Lang shrugged. As I pressed record, Amelia slipped out and closed the door quietly behind her. The first thing that strikes me, I said, is that you aren't really a politician at all, in the conventional sense, even though you've been so amazingly successful. I mean, when you were growing up, no one would have expected you to become a politician, would they? No, said Lang, not at all. I had absolutely no interest in politics, either as a child or as a teenager. I thought people who were obsessed by politics were weird. I still do, as a matter of fact. I like playing football, I like theatre and the movies. A bit later on, I like going out with girls. I never dreamt I might become a politician. Most student politicians struck me as complete nerds. Bingo, I thought. We'd only been working 2 minutes, and already we had a potential opening for the book right there. So what changed? What turned you on to politics? Turned on is about right, said Lang with a laugh. I'd left Cambridge, drifted for a year, really, hoping that a play I'd been involved in might get taken up by a theatre in London. But it didn't happen, and so I ended up working in a bank, living in this grotty basement flat in Lambeth, feeling very sorry for myself. And I remember it was a Sunday afternoon, raining, and someone starts knocking at the door. It was a story he must have told 1,000 times, but you wouldn't have guessed it, watching him that morning. He was sitting back at his chair, smiling at the memory, going over the same old words, using the same rehearsed gestures. And I thought, what an old trooper he was. The sort of pro who'd always make an effort to put on a good show, whether he had an audience of 1 or 1 million. And this person just wouldn't go away. And, you know, I'd had a bit to drink the night before and what have you. And I'm moaning and groaning. I've got the pillow over my head, but it starts up again. Knock, knock, knock. So eventually I get out of bed and I open the door. And there's this gorgeous girl. She's wringing wet from the rain, but she launches into this speech about the local elections. And so I invite her in, I make her a cup of tea, and she dries off, and that's it. I'm in love. And it quickly becomes clear that the best way of getting to see her again is to turn up the next Tuesday evening, or whenever it is, and join the local party, which I do. And this is Ruth. This is Ruth. And if she'd been a member of a different political party, I'd have gone along and joined it just the same. I wouldn't have stayed in it, he added quickly. I mean, obviously, this was the start of a long political awakening for me, but everything would have been different if Ruth hadn't knocked on that door that afternoon and kept knocking. We worked all morning without a break, except for when a tape was filled. Then I would briefly hurry downstairs to hand it over to be transcribed. I took him carefully through his early years, focusing on the impressions and physical objects of his childhood. The semi-detached home on a housing estate in Leicester. The personalities of his father, a builder, and his mother, a teacher. The quiet, apolitical values of the English provinces in the 60s, where the only sounds to be heard on a Sunday were church bells and the chimes of ice cream vans. The muddy Saturday morning games of football at the local park, and the long summer afternoons of cricket down by the river. Sitting there in Reinhardt's study, the minutiae of English life, nearly half a century earlier, seemed as remote as bric-a-brac in a Victorian trompe-l'oeil, and you might have thought about as relevant, but there was cunning in my method, and Lang, with his genius for empathy, grasped it at once. What we need to do, I told him, is to persuade the reader to identify emotionally with Adam Lang. Because if I know nothing else about this business, I know this. Once you have the reader's sympathy, they'll follow you anywhere. We swapped memories for hour after hour. And I will not say we began to concoct a childhood for Lang exactly, but we certainly pooled our experiences to such an extent that a few of my memories inevitably became blended into his. We decided that his first memory would be when he tried to run away from home at the age of 3, and he heard the sound of his father's footsteps coming up behind him and his muscled arms as he scooped him back to the house. We remembered his mother ironing and the smell of wet clothes on a wooden frame drying in front of a coal fire, and how he liked to pretend that the clothes horse was a house. We remembered Christmas pantomimes he had been to and his stage debut in the school nativity play. Was I a wise man? Well, that sounds a little smug. A sheep. Not smug enough. A guiding star. Perfect. When we broke for lunch and Lang went off to play tennis with one of his bodyguards, I dropped by the downstairs office to check on the transcription. For the first time since arriving on the island, I felt the warm breath of optimism. "This is all new to me," said Amelia, who was bent over Lucy's shoulder, reading Lang's words as they unfurled across the screen. "I've never heard him mention any of this before." "The human memory is a treasure house, Amelia," I said, deadpan. "It's merely a matter of finding the right key." I left her peering at the screen and went back upstairs, still clutching my silent phone. I had had an idea, and my newborn confidence gave me the courage to act on it. I went into the study and closed the door. I plugged Amelia's flash drive into my laptop. Then I attached a cable from the computer to my cell phone and dialed up the internet. The moment I was online, I addressed an email to myself, attached the manuscript file, and pressed send. The upload seemed to take an age. Amelia started calling my name from downstairs. I glanced at the door, and suddenly my fingers were thick and clumsy with anxiety. "Your file has been transferred," said the female voice, which for some reason is favoured by my internet service provider. "You have email," she announced a fraction later. Immediately, I yanked the cable out of the laptop and had just removed the flash drive, when somewhere in the big house a klaxon started. At the same time, there was a hum and a rattle above the window behind me, and I spun round to see a heavy metal shutter dropping from the ceiling. I groped for the door, and when I flung it open, the unfiltered sound of the siren was strong enough to vibrate my stomach. I heard footsteps coming up the steps, and then a sabre of light flashed into the big room. "Sorry, sir," came a policeman's voice from the darkness. "I didn't realise there was anyone up there." It was a drill. They held it once a week. Lockdown, I think they called it. And as the shutters rose, and the pale wash of Atlantic light was released back into the house, Amelia came into the living room to apologise for not having warned me. "It must have made you jump." "You could say that." "What of advice?" Her glossy pink lips parted in a smile, but her big, clear blue eyes were as cold as crystal. "Don't go wandering around too much on your own. The security boys don't like it."